Public Safety Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, April 4th, 2007. We will continue the public hearing on Senate Bill 5533, the budget of the Oregon State Police. And, Mr. Wilson, would you like to help tee it up for us?
A couple of things before the agency comes to the table, or as they come to the table. There are an addition ad page here, which, if you don't mind, I'll just pass down the table to add. It goes after page 66 in your document. And so if you could put it in there, it's under the Criminal Division tab. The next thing is that public testimony on this budget is scheduled for Monday at 3 o'clock. So make sure folks that are interested in testifying are here, and I would suggest before 3 o'clock. I have no idea how many people are going to be here. If anyone, including the agency, thinks there's going to be multitudes of people, please let me know in case I have to get a different room. This is not the largest room in the building. The other thing is, and I will, this is for members, I'll pass this down, and before looking at it, if you could read the memo on top, I'd appreciate it, but this should give you some information on the state police budget and the co-chair's budget, a comparison, but do please read the memo on the front of it for now. This will hopefully make it a little easier to understand what was distributed to you previously on the state police budget on the co-chair's distribution. Thank you.
And before we get started, I also wanted to call to the committee's attention and anybody else who might be listening that tomorrow is the day that the governor will be co-hosting with Congresswoman Hooley the event for returning servicemen and women, soldiers from Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. And so that is happening, I believe, in Hearing Room 50. So if you're interested in participating in that event that I think is happening most of the morning, I would suggest you get in touch with Paul Evans in the governor's office or have your staff do so. I think it's right around 9 or 9:15 there'll be an opening to it, and I plan on being there. And, some of you I thought might like to be there as well. All right. With that, why don't we go ahead and resume.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Captain Ed Maury, the Director of the Criminal Investigation Division. The division provides investigative services in support of criminal justice agencies statewide. This service is provided by assigning resources throughout the state to participate in various interagency teams, such as major crimes response, multidisciplinary child sex abuse, drug enforcement, computer crime, fire and post-blast investigations, homeland security, and tobacco tax compliance. We also provide support with professional staff through the Sex Offender Registration Unit, our Investigative Analytical Support Unit, and our Investigative Report Section. Our goal is to provide an exceptional level of specialized investigative support and expertise to local and federal law enforcement agencies and augment local law enforcement investigative resources. Going in and starting into key budget drivers and workload trends, I want to first describe, as you know, the heading investigative caseload. An investigative caseload is carried by each detective in the various sections of the division, whether it is drug enforcement, major crimes, homeland security, or arson. Caseload is probably best described as the number of various criminal investigations or cases each detective is assigned. Each investigation is different. Some are resolved sooner, and others will be more complex in nature, requiring more resources and time to resolve. Detectives prioritize each workday to determine which of the assigned pending cases they need to follow up on. They may work on 3 to 5 different cases each day. This depends on when interviews can be conducted with witnesses or suspects, the need to seize potential evidence pertinent to an investigation, or pursuing a strong investigative leave that comes that day. You won't see detectives with Franklin planners, obviously, because your day can go down the hill fast on that. Complex cases impacts a detective's caseload. Some examples of complex investigations are homicides, such as the recent state penitentiary homicide investigation that required numerous intensive interviews of inmates, staff, and review of video camera recordings. Police officer-involved shootings, public official misconduct, the SAFE investigation we did several years ago, as well as a child abuse investigation that may involve multiple victims around the state. These complex investigations must be worked in conjunction with their normal caseload and on many occasions involve the necessity for overtime. The bigger the caseload a detective carries, the more it negatively impacts their ability to resolve investigations as it takes longer for investigative resolution to occur in most instances. This may be more apparent in the rural areas of the state where only one detective is assigned to conduct investigations in certain communities and works in conjunction with local law enforcement agency detectives. In rural areas, it is fairly routine for a drug enforcement or an arson detective to assist a major crimes detective on an investigation or vice versa. We have been noting an increase in identity theft cases in the Willamette Valley area, which have inundated local law enforcement agencies. State police detectives routinely confer with local law enforcement investigators as it usually involves the same suspect or suspects and is usually related to methamphetamine. The next category, state institutions. State institution crimes are investigated by major crime section detectives. The majority of investigations are the more serious inmate versus inmate crimes, as well as any crimes that may involve institution staff. We work closely with the Department of Corrections Inspector General Unit. Each new state institution that is constructed, has an impact to the local field investigative offices as it adds additional investigations on the respective detective or office caseload. At times, this additional work can be absorbed without a significant impact, as experienced by the Klamath Falls Investigative Office for the Warner Creek facility in Lakeview. The Klamath Falls office currently has a division supervisor, three major crimes detectives, as well as a drug enforcement detective. We also, on occasion, field criminal investigation requests from the State School for the Blind and School for the Deaf. Cybercrime and ID theft, another big issue. Cybercrime and ID theft involve the use of the Internet and computers. Computers are routinely used in identity theft to commit loan scams, credit card fraud, check forgery, and falsified identification. Individuals prey on children and young juveniles through the use of chat rooms or MySpace.com. These types of investigations are on the increase. This has a direct impact on the computer forensics investigative requests we receive from local law enforcement. Some larger local law enforcement agencies have implemented their own computer forensics detective to handle their own cases and will conduct examinations on occasions for other local law enforcement in their immediate area. We respond to any local law enforcement forensics examination request. The most critical issue in this is maintaining an expertise level and staying up to date with the latest technology, training, and equipment, which is a yearly cost driver, which is a norm for the pace of the technology industry today.
Excuse me, Mr. Maurer.
I just have a question. In investigating or working with cybercrimes, MySpace.com, are there any barriers to getting the information out of?
On the MySpace.com issues, from what I'm trying to remember from a computer forensics, the federal government, who does a lot of the cybercrime, internet predator type chat deals, has some federal legislation that are involved. Usually it requires us to obviously get a subpoena to get information from them on that piece.
So you would follow up. So you would need to go through the federal agency in order to get what you need.
Sheriff Seal, Senator Winters, the federal agencies, the FBI has a cybercrime unit up in Portland that specifically deals with this. When you talk about cybercrime, when you're doing internet predators, you're working in an undercover capacity. MySpace.com would be somebody searching that deal and finding, as my daughter posted on there, pictures and stuff. So when you get into those types of deals of who's hitting or actively pinging on that MySpace.com, trying to get the email, and then trying to get the internet provider protocol of who that is. A lot of times, like I said, I don't have a undercover unit that does the stings right now. We just do the forensics piece. Drug investigations. Drug investigations, specifically methamphetamine, are being targeted by drug task forces who participate in, as well as the meth initiative team, who have refocused their efforts towards drug trafficking organizations. These investigations require intensive investigative resources and time using mobile and aerial surveillance, obtaining both hardline and cell phone records, and also requires purchasing larger amounts of drugs to work up the pyramid of the organization. Detectives assigned in rural drug task forces work street to mid-level and often turn significant cases over to a federal drug task force. Street-level drug cases most commonly end up being linked to identity theft cases involving mail theft, false identification, and fraud involving organized groups. We continue to receive staff requests for rural drug task forces. We also work closely with the Patrol Services Division, conducting investigative follow-up on any large drug or currency seizure a patrol trooper encounters as a result of a traffic stop. You may have heard of two significant drug cases in the news recently. One involved the seizure of 20 pounds of heroin, and the other involved the seizure of methamphetamine and the arrest of several individuals in the Corvallis-Benton County area. The heroin seizure, even though it was a federal case, involved a Drug Enforcement Section detective from the Oregon State Police who was the main case agent. He's assigned to the Eugene Drug Enforcement Administration Office as a task force officer. The Meth Initiative team was heavily involved in supporting the Corvallis Police Department investigation over an eight-month period. This case culminated using the majority of our Drug Enforcement Section detectives and other agency drug task force detectives around the state, assisting on the execution of multiple search warrants to seize evidence related to both investigations on the same day. Sex offender registration. In sex offender registration, the biggest driver is the growing pace of 115 new sex offenders required to register each month, which affects workload for the sex offender registration unit. The unit is required to prove an offender is required to register under Oregon law. Initial registrations for Oregon convictions require research and analysis of the criminal history information, court indictment and judgment documents, police reports, Department of Corrections risk assessments, psychological evals, and supervisory information. They also conduct research on information from the Oregon Youth Authority on adjudicated juveniles for juvenile sex offenders. Other workload that impacts this unit is the numerous telephone, email, and fax requests received and responded to, information regarding registration requirements, specific offenders, persons not in the registry, and explanation of Oregon relief from registration statutes for adults and juveniles are received daily from law enforcement, registered sex offenders, and the public. Calls from other states, either requesting information on sex offenders moving into their state or relaying information on sex offenders moving to Oregon, are also received and processed. The next category going on as far as improvements and efficiencies, I only have one to note. In the 2005 legislature enacted a law that was brought forth as a legislative concept by the agency that reduced the need for sex offender registration unit employees to attend grand jury in person by providing a sworn affidavit with information in lieu of personally appearing before a grand jury regarding cases involving sex offenders failing to register or change their address. This significantly reduced grand jury appearance and associated travel time, which allowed those hours to be redirected back into the unit. And as an example, in 2005, we had 137 court appearances. In 2006, we were down to 43. So we were able to return those hours back into the unit. Getting into performance and outcome measures, for the 2007 to the 2009 millennium, we have two key performance measures on crime reduction. Number 7 is related to the percent of major crime team call-out cases resolved within a 12-month period. This is tracked through monthly reports received from field offices. Our actual for 2005 was 92% with a target of 75%. 2006 actuals will be obtained after December of 2007. In comparison to the national clearance rate of 62.1% for murder and non-negligent manslaughter cases, solvability of major crimes by the major crime teams in Oregon averaged 88.2% over the past 5 years. Number 8 is a proposed performance measure related to the number of law enforcement agency assists in drug investigations by the Drug Enforcement Section detectives. This performance measure was instituted in 2005. And the target data for 2007 was selected based on the number of Drug Enforcement Section FTEs available and the number of investigative assists averaged out. We're currently exploring using another means for the target data, which we have proposed taking the sum of both averages from 2005 and 2006, which is an average of about 26.2, which we would use as an average starting baseline. This would provide a baseline of assistance the Drug Enforcement Section provides based on the number of available hours and FTE. Some assisted statistics captured include assisting task forces, or agencies on controlled narcotics purchases, surveillance operations, search warrant preparation and execution, as well as other substantive investigative support. An assist includes all investigations, whether the detective is the case officer, a co-case officer, or merely an assisting officer where support is provided to a drug task force or a local agency. An investigation qualifies as only one agency assist, regardless of the number of times a detective or multiple detectives have provided assistance. For example, two detectives may assist a local task force or law enforcement agency on a drug case. That would be tracked as one assist. Also incorporated as internal performance measures are the meth initiative team stats. This team, which is located in various areas of the state, began with a primary mission of investigating methamphetamine manufacturers and those who supply potential meth lab cooks. The focus initially was on chemical diversion and meth labs. Due to the significant reduction of the mom-and-pop labs with a pseudoephedrine restriction, the team has also focused on drug trafficking organizations who traffic methamphetamine into the state and work closely with the Drug Enforcement Administration and operate multi-jurisdictionally, serving various drug task forces upon request. In key legislation, the only bill I have report on, Senate Bill 181 eliminates the sunset clause for continuous appropriation of cigarette tax and tobacco product tax revenues to fund the Tobacco Compliance Task Force. It's included in the governor's recommended budget, and the task force has presented testimony before the Finance and Revenue Committee. This bill was moved from the committee with amendments back then of an 8-year sunset provision. It's still being worked on, I believe, and for the task force to report back to the legislature in 4 years on the impacts and accomplishments of the task force, but I believe that's still under review right now. Policy option packages. Policy option package number 101, dealing with essential infrastructure. It restores some infrastructure costs related to the fuel inflation rate for the Criminal Investigation Division. Number 205, titled Identity Theft. This package would add 4 sworn positions and 2 analysts to focus on identity theft crimes. 2 of the sworn positions would be assigned to be trained and equipped to be computer forensics detectives to support the increasing demand for forensics computer examinations by local law enforcement related to identity theft and other associated crimes. The other 2 sworn positions would be assigned to work in the Washington County and Mid-Willamette Valley area in support of local law enforcement agencies working identity theft cases. The research analyst will be able to provide investigative support and analysis to local law enforcement agencies requesting assistance. A performance measure related to identity theft case resolution will track the number of identity theft cases each detective and analyst provides assistance or investigative support on, as well as the number of cases investigated with resolution. These positions would be phased in August of 2007. Number 206, titled Narcotics and Major Crimes. This package provides 8 detective positions for drug and major crime investigations, as well as an additional staff resource for the Sex Offender Registration Unit. We have received requests from several rural drug task forces to provide an investigator for methamphetamine investigations. Other positions would be assigned to major crime investigations, which will assist on investigative caseloads in some offices. The position for the Sex Offender Registration Unit will address the growing number of sex offender registrations the unit is experiencing. These positions will not be phased in until January of 2008. Number 208, Infrastructure Field Support. This is related to the infrastructure and is the allocated cost for the division for the Bend facility based on the number of division resources there in Bend. Policy option package number 302, the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. Again, this package provides funding for the Tobacco Compliance Task Force and requires a sunset to be removed from Senate Bill 181 to continue the funding appropriations for the task force. The task force enforces the state and federal cigarette laws and tobacco tax laws, investigates, prosecutes, and deters tax evasion of the tobacco laws. It continues to focus enforcement efforts towards retailers, distributors, and smugglers and responds accordingly to the changing methods of those who are inclined to commit tobacco tax fraud. In the last policy option package, number 303, titled the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area, this package restores 3 limited duration positions, which are non-sworn, in the Oregon HIDA Administrative Office to continue program administration, bless you, program and oversight of the federal HIDA program, which is funded through the Office of National Drug Control Policy. The Oregon HIDA program receives federal funds yearly for enforcement and prosecution of drug crimes in high intensity designated areas of the state. Currently, there are 8 counties designated as HIDAs: Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah, Marion, Jackson, Douglas, Deschutes, and Umatilla. Chair Shields and members of the committee, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
My colleagues, taking a look at the information that Mr. Wilson just passed around to you, policy option package 302 is not on this list because that is not general fund or CFAA dollars, in case you're wondering.
Say again, it's not general fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, package number 302 is funded as a transfer of revenue or transfer of funds from the Department of Revenue. It comes off the top of the tobacco tax revenues, and then Department of Revenue spends money, that source of funds, on their staff as well as DOJ and state police. So it's transferred and comes in as other funds. So it's the only difference. And, Mr. Chair, one other note. Package 303, the HIDTA funds, the agency, the Department of Justice and the state police have come forward suggesting that they transfer administration of HIDTA from state police to Department of Justice because the program is more integrated in DOJ's everyday operations, and so that will probably be part of our recommendation. So it doesn't change the bottom line at all in terms of the state government. It just will change, really, Package 303 sort of moves over to Department of Justice. And that's an agreement between those two agencies.
Senator Burdick, then Representative Barker.
Thank you. You were talking about being able to divert resources from the mom-and-pop meth labs to other areas of the meth problem. Can you be a little more specific as to where you're concentrating your efforts now?
Sure. Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, what I was talking about, I think when we first implemented the meth initiative, we were really going after the people who were smurfing the pseudoephedrine and were supplying the meth labs. Since we have a reduction on that, they are still probably doing 30% of the cases we're still following up on. We're seeing some stuff that's coming from out of state. But what the meth initiative teams, like they did down in Corvallis, I don't know if you were here, but the Corvallis PD case, which took an eight-month investigation, I think we deployed at times anywhere from 3 to 6 detectives because of the continuous surveillance required when you're doing these drug investigations. So they're actually kind of out on loan when we get a request from a drug task force that says, hey, we need some additional bodies to do surveillance and stuff like that. They're going out and working these drug trafficking organization cases, which are one of your bigger size cases.
And to follow up, Mr. Chair, what about there's more and more evidence that drugs are coming in by car, you know, from California and Mexico. What is your role in that?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, our role, prior criminal investigation with the Drug Enforcement Section, again, when a trooper stops a significant load in a car, there are some decisions that need to be made at that point in time. Rather than sometime just talking and just arresting a person, there may be some point in whether the person may be willing to continue the delivery of that load to its destination source. You have a point A to a point B that becomes very critical in a drug investigation of trying to find the source and the organization that does it. So we provide a lot of assistance in debriefing the person that the troopers have stopped and found in there. Do we want to take the load to the next point? Is there any information, what we would call notes or pager numbers or whatever else that may tie back? Because in today's world of investigations with all the databases, I'm sure you heard Steve Briggs from DOJ talk about the HIDTA Intel Center. When we work a case, we can plug in the cell phone numbers of the dealers to the database. So if this person's connected here, we can run the database and find out that the DEA Fresno may have a case in that point. So we're really in a follow-up role type of that. Probably the best way to explain it too, you know, when a trooper does a great job on the road seizing that drug quantity and you have the two people, one person to transport it, drug enforcement section, sometimes you don't get the biggest size quantities, but we work in organizations, so you get more bodies on a conspiracy case.
Okay. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being a few minutes late again this afternoon. It may be that my question is something that can't be answered directly during this testimony, but you may have some sort of observation. about this morning's rather long story on a national radio network about the topic of meth interdiction and investigation and meth crimes. I don't know if you're aware of it. It was a long story. It's about a situation in another state, but it's not unlike ours. It's another state that has controlled the pseudoephedrine sales. So these small manufacturing labs in the local communities have decreased. There's hardly any of that going on. So on the plus side, it's wonderful that we have fewer exposures for people who live in the neighborhoods, for people who may be living in the houses, and for law enforcement and other first responders, less exposure to very dangerous, possibly explosive or toxic situations. On the other side, though, and what I wanted to ask about is that the comment from this other story, the takeaway for me, the lesson is that we've pushed the problem into another area where we've decreased the danger of the existence of the meth lab, but the persons who are dealing or selling or, you know, arranging the organizations that sell the meth coming from other places, that there's actually what appears to be an increased level of more violent crime because of how these other sales organizations manage their business, that where the local meth labs were run by, you know, they were mom and pop operations on a very small scale, that what this other story indicated is that the consequences of going crossways with somebody, it leads to much more violent crime in the community.
Chair Shields, Representative Nathan, I think I can answer that for you. The mom-and-pop labs, you know, trust me, meth is not a stranger to Oregon. I was working methamphetamine when I was working narcotics in 85 to 89. Back then, the methamphetamine was based under phenyl-2-propanone. And basically, when you start getting the molecular structure of meth and Devo and Dextro and Levo, DNL, what part stays in the body, what you have today, the pseudoephedrine, obviously, you're probably aware the molecule is so similar in nature to meth. So you almost have a very more potent meth when they converted, when we saw the lab cooks go from P2P to the pseudoephedrine. With that, you do have a higher incidences, I think. You get into dangers, I think. I was always tracking contacts on the road with traffic officers because the current meth puts you in a fight or flight syndrome, and that can be very dangerous for a lone officer stopping somebody that's under the influence of meth. It does drive violent crime, obviously. When we addressed the mom-and-pop labs, the drug task forces so were inundated that they couldn't really work the organizations. Now that we're working the organizations, and some of them are very well organized crime, and some of them you have a lot of homicides that are related to it as well. I think now that we can divert to that, I think we've always seen this methamphetamine from Mexico actually is always coming in. But the idea for the mom-and-pop labs was if we can just take care of that situation and re-divert our resources back to where we were, then it's going to be a better thing. And I think that's probably why you're starting to see some more significant cases coming out right now. I hope that kind of answers it.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain, in package 205 and 206, there's a total of 15 positions between those two packages. Is it your impression that when we sort of generically the legislature or executive branch talk about adding new troopers, that those 15 are part of the new troopers? In general terms, do you think of those as being part of that new trooper base?
Churchill's representative, I'm not sure if I understand your question. No, yeah, you can maybe rephrase that.
If you pick up the newspaper and read where the legislature has a plan to add 139 new troopers,
sure.
Are the 15 people that are mentioned in those two packages that I mentioned part of that 139?
No. Sheriff Shields, Representative Hanna, I think the governor's recommended budget is the 139 troopers, and the additional detectives in these positions are above that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Barker.
And are the detectives trooper rank? Are they higher rank? Are they higher paid? And how are they selected?
Representative Shields, Chair Shields, Representative Barker. They get the title grade of detective. Unlike Portland Police Bureau, when you make detective grade, it's promotion. So a trooper, senior trooper. It's just the assignment in my division, they're called a detective. They're still that trooper, senior trooper level rate. There's no more pay, but I'm sure I'll probably hear about it. So.
just a quick question.
Senator Nelson.
It sounds like from all the additional pays, you're not planning on any real reduction in crime. The crime is out there. You just need folks to pick them up.
Chair Shields, Senator Nelson. Yeah, I think I've been in the business for 28 years, and I think it, when you start talking about trying to get up to a point of getting enough resources where we are in a very reactive state patrol division, you're holding the finger on the dike. And being able to get on some of these things, such as identity theft, most of your identity theft is probably created by certain specific groups of people. And the fight team up in Washington County targets these people. And I was talking to a Beaverton PD officer, but by targeting, their identity theft crime rates and burglaries just went poof. So I think, you know, when you're in this business, when you've got that, I think we have to be a little bit smarter in how we do this. We use a lot of software technology. The resources make it better because you can jump on your investigative leads. And sometimes you end up trying to have to track these people down because they're always on the move.
Thank you.
Well, that's what I was trying to understand.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Next up, David Yendel.
I think I have that, sure. All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Yendel. I am the director of the Information Management Division, which is organizationally under the Support Services Bureau. The division consists of four sections, the Criminal Justice Information Services and Identification Services sections, which serve all authorized law enforcement agencies in the state and regulatory agencies throughout the state, and the Enterprise Services and Wireless Services sections, which serve only OSP. My presentation of each section will be in the same order, and I would call your attention to page 73, I believe, in your packet. Before I begin, however, I'd like to provide you with a brief explanation of the CJIS or the LEDS system to maybe help explain the way this particular section is structured. I'd like to start by calling your attention to the left side of the diagram. It's labeled Message Switch, and immediately under it is the CrimeView database. The LED system essentially consists of two primary components. One is the message switch, to which all of the users throughout the state of Oregon are connected. There are currently approximately 23,000 devices that are connected to LEDs. The CrimeView system itself is where the criminal history records are maintained and what we refer to as the hot files. These are stolen vehicles, wanted persons, sex offenders, concealed handgun permits. All of that type of information is located in the LEDS database, which is represented by the designation of the CrimeView database. You'll notice to the right all of the other boxes are the other criminal justice databases located throughout the country and in the state of Oregon that LEDS is connected to, and to which all of our customers throughout the state of Oregon acquire criminal justice information in order to do their work. So if you, in the course of my presentation regarding CJIS and LEDS, if you have any specific questions about that, I hope this helps to kind of put that into perspective. The Criminal Justice Information Services section is the hub for collecting and disseminating criminal justice information in Oregon and serves as the home of the law enforcement data system, better known as LEDS. The section consists of 22 staff members responsible for the operation and maintenance of the LEDS message switch and database systems, operation of the 24-hour LEDS Oregon Emergency Response System, which we refer to as OERS, Coordination Center, which is a partnership with the State Office of Emergency Management, maintaining the LEDS training and quality assurance audit programs, and operation of the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting Program. There are four key budget drivers for this section. Budget driver number one for the section is increased demand for criminal justice information. LEDS was created in 1969 with a primary purpose of promoting officer safety through information sharing. Over the years, the need for a comprehensive criminal history data has grown, and the demand for purposes other than just law enforcement has expanded to include regulatory considerations and the licensing of those who are placed in positions of trust within government, our schools, health and human services, and child welfare. LEDS is recognized as a core mission-critical public safety system. Budget driver number two is increased system use. Since January of 1995, we have experienced a 407% increase in devices. This would include, as I mentioned before, workstations that have LEDS-capable software on them, handhelds, PDAs, and mobile data terminals, each with access to LEDS. For reference purposes, in the first date that I mentioned, 1995, we had 4,200 devices connected. Today, we have right at 23,000 devices connected to LEDS. We currently process over 25 million messages a month, with over 570,000 LEDS responses per week directed to users right here in Oregon. The trend on system usage has been to double every 10 years. Increased usage trends in Oregon are reflected throughout the nation, with a growing number of out-of-state LEDS queries received each week. To apply the numbers, we currently receive an average of 50,000 out-of-state queries each week from approximately 8,000 agencies located outside the state of Oregon. Budget driver number three for this section is new technology. Legislative and technical changes at the state and national levels have resulted in increased demand for information and services, requiring what seems to be the constant upgrade of the technology we use. The needs of our business truly drives the technology we require. And budget driver number four is enhanced services. As information systems evolve and user requests new services, the system must change to meet the needs of its customers and to take advantage of new information sharing initiatives. Continuous improvements and efficiencies for this section include our partnerships with the Oregon Judicial Department. OSP and the Oregon Judicial Department, and I'll refer to them as OJD, are in the process of co-locating OJD's servers and communications equipment with the law enforcement data system. OJD's present facilities do not offer earthquake protection, security, and environmental conditioning. This is your HVAC, your heating and air conditioning, emergency power, uninterrupted power supplies, generators, etc., required to support their mission-critical IT systems essential to our statewide court system. Co-location with LEDS will improve OJD's computer systems and facility security, in addition to promoting their overall IT infrastructure reliability. The co-location will afford both OSP and OJD the opportunity to explore further enhancements of the state's criminal justice information system. Further, OSP and ODOT may share in an estimated $2,000 in monthly reduction in rent as a result of the co-location. I mentioned ODOT because ODOT is also located in the same facility that LEDS and the Office of Emergency Management is located out in the Anderson Readiness Center. So the location of OJD's infrastructure via the DAS rent payments that they will pay will actually help to offset the cost of ODOT and OSP rent in that facility. OSP and OJD also enjoy a continuing partnership established since 2002 to audit the accuracy and completeness of the state's criminal history system. OJD plays a key role in feeding court disposition data to LEDS and the criminal history system via the Oregon Justice Information Network, referred to as OJIN. Our partnership with the Office of Emergency Management is another example. CEGIS has continued its partnership with Oregon Emergency Management to consolidate the 24/7 OEM ORS Coordination Center and the LEDS Operations Center, resulting in personnel savings and increased efficiency for these programs. Consolidation allowed OEM and CEGIS LEDS to share staff resources necessary to support the mutual requirements of a 24/7 facility. Savings have been realized through the elimination of redundant infrastructure and on-call payments to OEM personnel who were not on duty in a 24-hour status. Our partnership with the Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles is yet another example. The CEGIS section and DMV have entered into a partnership to provide photos through LEDs to authorized users. Oregon is one of the first states in the nation to provide this service, which is another tool to provide law enforcement with the means of determining positive identification. DMV presently charges law enforcement agencies $6.50 per hard copy photo. Accessed through LEDs, the cost is zero to the requesting agency. At the current rate of 1,000 photos per day, this service represents a cumulative statewide savings of at least $2,372,000 to Oregon law enforcement.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative.
Thank you. Very quick question. When you say a daily savings of approximately $6,500 statewide, is that savings that would go to, for example, city and county law enforcement agencies?
Chair Shields.
They're not spending.
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, it's $6.50 per hard copy for the photo is what they currently pay. So if Ontario Police Department were to call Oregon DMV and request a photo, it would cost them for that single photo $6.50. Acquired directly through LEDs, the cost is 3 cents. We currently pay that charge as a part of our assessment that we receive from DMV. We pay about $13,000 a month to DMV for services that DMV provides for Oregon law enforcement. So the answer to your question is yes. It comes back to a savings to the local law enforcement agencies.
Thank you.
At the current rate of 1,000 photos per day, I think I already mentioned that, CEGIS is extending this new capability to other states in addition to Oregon, making Oregon the first state in the nation to successfully share driver's license photos through its state message switch. So this is a new service. Out-of-state agencies currently request approximately 500 photos a year, spending at least $3,250. Once out-of-state agencies are able to receive the photos through LEDs, their cost will also drop to zero. Required due to constitutional considerations of Oregon's highway funds, the cost of providing the service at 3 cents per photo is a component part of the $13,000 per month we pay to DMV for services they provide LEDs on behalf of Oregon law enforcement. Next area is LEDs technology audit. After assessing how our users throughout the state connect to LEDs, we determined that we were using outdated and increasingly costly circuit technology. As a result of our assessment, we have completed the statewide migration to IP, or Internet Protocol-based connections to LEDs. The result has been significantly reduced cost and significantly increased bandwidth. The bottom line here is more service at less cost. And next is the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting System replacement. Using federal grant funds, we've received a grant for $367,000. CEGIS is in the process of procuring the replacement of our OUCR program computing platform and software used to support this statewide system. For those of you that may not be familiar with the UCR program, under Oregon law, all law enforcement agencies are required to report their offense data to the state police. That information is used to put together a statistical report of crime in Oregon. That information is used for everything from the Department of Corrections in forecasting prison bed requirements. It's used by many of the universities to study crime trends in the state. That information also goes to the FBI and is incorporated into their series report on crime in the United States. This will be the first replacement of this mission-critical repository and statistical tool in 17 years. This replacement will allow for improved information sharing and statistical analysis. The system will be the conduit for national crime information sharing through the FBI's newly created Law Enforcement National Data Exchange, or INDEX, system, which will be in production the middle of this year. Our timeline for implementation will allow Oregon to participate in phase one of this national initiative. Of equal importance is the new system replacement will reduce paper transactions to zero and provide real-time crime information to law enforcement agencies throughout the state. The cost to CEGIS will be the required match of $91,813. In addition to significantly improving the delivery of OUCR services, we will immediately save the $95,000 that we are currently paying to support the existing system. Performance outcomes for this section include, we have a 99.9% system availability benchmark, which is our uptime. This measurement is the cornerstone and hallmark of LEDS. If either component of LEDS is down, the message switch or the database, someone could die. For reference purposes, the FBI requires that each state maintain at least 98% system availability. For the past 6 months, LEDS message switch availability has been on average 99.987%, and this runs out to an hour and 12 minutes per year in downtime. Next is to make Oregon uniform crime reporting information more reliable and timely through the system enhancement. And this measure will be accomplished through completion of the OUCR IT system replacement project by or before July the 1st of 2007. Next is to ensure a reliable network with no CJIS information compromises through user assistance, system programming, auditing, and training. And this measure will be validated through our triennial LEDS customer audits and spot checks as required. A prioritized list of programs and services for this section include a LEDS message switch and database system support and maintenance, the LEDS ORS coordination center operations, LEDS audit program, which consists of our quality control and technical audits, the LEDS training program, and the OUCR program. Policy option packages for this section include Package 101, Essential Infrastructure. This package would provide a full-time LEDS message switch analyst, a training and development specialist, a compliance specialist, and an information security officer. As mandated by ORS 181730, LEDS shall install and maintain a criminal justice telecommunications and information system for storage and retrieval of criminal justice information submitted for Oregon. As part of this effort, OSP partners with the FBI's National Crime Information Center, or NCIC, which provides access to a national databank of criminal justice information. In order to access NCIC, the state must meet specific standards for training, security, data integrity, and systems utilization. Given the budget reductions over the last few biennia, OSP has attempted to maintain these standards with federal grants and one-time funding sources. These resources are no longer available, and the agency has received letters of possible sanction from the FBI. The positions provided under this package will allow us to provide 24-hour technical support of the LEDS message switch and a minimal training and audit program necessary to comply with FBI policy and the shared management of NCIC. The outcome measure, should we be fortunate enough to receive approval of this package, will be to provide for the integrity of the law enforcement data system by conducting triennial audits of 100% of the agencies which have access to LEDS, verifying information usage, and network security. This is one of the minimal requirements of the FBI. We'll also enhance user knowledge by conducting 4 regional training sessions and 1 user conference per year, ensure comprehensive user manuals by conducting quarterly manual reviews, and maintain 99.9% LEDS availability through 24-hour technical support and the prompt updates of system access tables as determined by monthly status reports. Package 208, Infrastructure and Field Support. This package would provide a full-time administrative specialist 1 position to support the LEDS training program. This is another position we have attempted to maintain using federal grants and one-time funding sources. These funds, as I mentioned before, are no longer available. The outcome measure for this package, if approved, will support our customers who require LEDS access by conducting annual training, status validations of all Oregon LEDS users. We have approximately 14,000 users that are certified in the state today. Issuing user training certificates within 5 days of training completion, and the issuance of LEDS user training guides within 2 days of the request of the agency. That concludes my presentation for the LEDS CJIS section, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Quick question. In your policy packages, I think I calculated very quickly, there's about 16 FTEs for
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, I believe that's correct. That's not all in this particular section, however. That's spread throughout the division.
Is there any one component with a higher priority than another?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, I would have to say that given our current staffing status, they're all very critical to our programs.
Did we expect to hear anything else? Senator Nelson.
I think you've got a lot of new software proposed and coming in. You talk to a lot of different people. Will those people have to change their software in order to talk to your people, with your people?
Chair Shields, Senator Nelson, the changes that we have gone through, an example would be the conversion from our old, what we refer to as our BiSync connections to LEDs. Agencies throughout the state were required to buy and license their own copies of their workstation software. This was a local cost that they had to cover in providing that service. But that's always been the way LEDs has been provided. Anything that is required of the local agency to access LEDs, they've been responsible for. So this is didn't pose any new financial burden on the local agencies.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Chair, I'm just going back to my point. I mean, we have a system. You affect one part of the system, the whole system.
Chair Shields, Senator Nelson, if I might, our philosophy in providing service to our local customers has been to the degree that we can simplify their access at no additional cost, that we seek that avenue. And another example would be the index project that I mentioned before. This is a nationwide project, and every state is approaching it a little differently. We've chosen to take advantage of Oregon law enforcement's already engaging requirement to submit their offense data monthly to LEDs for the UCR program. They will be asked to voluntarily increase the amount of data that would be used to support the index program. But the new system that I mentioned that we are replacing with the UCR program, that will actually be Oregon's gateway to the index program. So all they need to do voluntarily is to give us more data, which is input to the FBI system. The benefit to them will be more information that can be used in investigations. It actually benefits the local agencies through their participation.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Is there any water in that?
Okay. Mr. Chair, before he continues, just Senator Winters asked about the staffing. I think the important thing in this division, much of the staff that's being added here really already exists and is losing their funding or has lost it in terms of the LEDs system, and we're using general fund to provide the funding for that position. And with you know, unless you increase or continue the staff, you're at risk of losing federal certification, which has a number of or receiving federal sanctions, I guess is the proper way of saying it. And you're at risk of losing some federal funds as well as putting constraint on a system that all law enforcement, the courts, and everyone depends on with the LEDs system.
Doug, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your clarification, but it is a very relevant question as so we begin to look at what's in and what's out and to know the value of the 16 positions that you identified.
Mr. Chair.
I think Senator Winters might be looking for a response.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, I have three other sections to cover. With the chair's permission, I'd like to come back to your question after I conclude, because the need for the additional positions will become clearer in the rest of my testimony. And I certainly would welcome your question.
So long as I really do think it's important that we know. And if you can clarify it, I would appreciate it. And if it's going to come later in your testimony, I can wait until you finish your testimony.
Or perhaps that might be one that would be more appropriate for the superintendent to respond to maybe tomorrow after you give it a little thought. Would that be responsive? What would, Would that be better, so that you're not put on the spot? Representative Cameron.
Well, thank you, and staff, bringing up a point, I guess, along with Senator Winters. I am concerned that how many of these positions that were these two policy option packages are here today. I couldn't find that information, that are here today that they're going to lose federal funding for, because I'm under the assumption these were new positions.
Mr. Chair, if I'm not mistaken, they're limited duration in the current biennium. Am I right, Monica? And they would end without new funding at the end of this biennium. No, I'd have to get the
all 13
and check
of
the
them.
Number. Well, keep in mind that all 16 are parts of three or four units or whatever. Then I'd have to go back and take a look at the number, and there are only a limited or a portion of those as part of the program he just described. There are three other programs he has yet to describe
Okay. That
make up those additional positions.
Is that responsive, Representative Kennedy?
Yeah, I'll wait to the whole.
Mr. Chair, I do have, unfortunately I didn't bring it with me, but I do have a division breakdown of positions in Governor's Rec, if that would be of help, be glad to provide that.
Yeah, well, and I think it's, you know, the recommendation that we need is the superintendent's, as we go through on what his priorities would be on these. And I don't want to put you in a position where you have to make that pitch, but you could put a little thought into that. Superintendent McLean, let us know. Let's keep motoring so we can get out of here. The full Ways and Means members have to be in Oregon City by 6:30. So
I guess I'd start by calling your attention to page 77. That's where we'll be picking up. Next is the Identification Services section, which serves as the state's sole source provider of criminal offender identification. The section consists of 73 staff members responsible for maintaining the following services: the automated fingerprint identification system, the computerized criminal history system, the clearinghouse background check process, regulatory background checks, the firearms instant check, concealed handgun checks, open records, and expungements. These services are used by every criminal justice and regulatory agency in Oregon to assist with the apprehension of criminals and promoting the public safety of our communities. There are three key budget drivers for this section. Budget driver one is increased workload. The demand for background checks continues to grow each year, both in numbers and the types of groups and or individuals on whom the checks are desired. Essential as a tool to protecting our most vulnerable populations, the sick, our children, the elderly, the non-criminal justice use of criminal history information is fast becoming the predominant use of this key component of our public safety system. Budget driver two is automation. The demands placed on the Identification Services section to balance workload on one hand with available staff on the other and meet expected and, in many instances, demanded turnaround times can only be accomplished through automation. The faster the computing infrastructure and more system interfaces we can utilize to expedite the processing of our growing workload, the more it allows us to keep pace. And budget driver three is staff retention and training. The standard training time for positions at ID Services is 6 months. Since applicant pools do not exist for persons who can make fingerprint identifications, the skill must be learned on the job. Since the majority of these positions pay entry-level wages, by the time a new hire is fully trained, they have acquired marketable skills, enabling them to move on to higher-paying positions. As a result, we are in the constant process of recruiting, hiring, and training new staff. Continuous improvements and efficiencies include effective scheduling. Shift scheduling enhances our ability to meet performance measure goals when we have a fully staffed and trained workforce. Three different shifts share the same workspace and equipment, limiting the need for redundant office equipment such as PC workstations and software licensing, office desk space and office supplies, and offsetting the need for additional rented floor space. Quality assurance. A comprehensive quality assurance program is the basis for ensuring a complete and accurate criminal history file. Inaccurate records can cause such impacts as officer and citizen safety, errors made in sentencing, false accusations, identity-related issues, defamation of character, and tort claims. automation process improvements. As previously mentioned, automation is key to our keeping pace with a growing workload. Automation improvements made during the current biennium have allowed us to continue to provide quality baseline services with existing staff levels. Additional improvements planned for the next biennium will enhance our service levels and increase our ability to complete functions that have not been possible with our existing staff levels. WIN participation. Oregon participates in a multi-state automated fingerprint identification system known as AFIS through the Western Identification Network. Shared with the states of Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Nevada, Utah, and most recently the state of Washington, shared management of the WIN multi-state fingerprint database affords Oregon access to more records, currently there are just under 22 million, and the potential of solving more crimes than if we maintained our own single-state system. We have one key performance measure and three outcome measures for this section. Key performance measure number 11 is identification services turnaround time. The average number of calendar days from the date of receipt of criminal justice fingerprint cards by the identification services section until the criminal justice data is posted into the computerized criminal history file. Our goal is an 8-day turnaround. We are currently producing a 5-day turnaround. Outcome measure number 1. Accurate and complete criminal history records are maintained with an acceptable turnaround for availability to criminal justice and non-criminal justice use in providing safety to all citizens. Measured through internal review of monthly statistics for unit workload and turnaround times, as well as federal record-keeping standards requirements for accuracy and completeness. Workload trends are used to project staffing level or offset through the use of technology and equipment when possible. Outcome measure number 2, children, seniors, and vulnerable Oregonians are better protected from harm through timely applicant background check screening for positions of trust, such as teachers, caregivers, medical professionals, and the like. Measured through internal review of monthly statistics for workload and turnaround times, trend charts and customer submission projections are used to determine appropriate staffing levels within projected revenue. All fees are periodically reviewed to assess workload fluctuations and costs for providing services. And last, outcome measure number 3, accurate and timely background checks are conducted to keep firearms out of the hands of prohibited persons, such as criminals and subjects with mental illness. Measured through review of monthly and yearly statistics for workload trends, turnaround times, and denial approval rates. Workload volumes and revenues are monitored also for staffing considerations as needed. A prioritized list of programs and services for this section include the AFIS system, the computerized criminal history system, clearinghouse background checks, regulatory background checks, firearm instant checks, concealed handgun checks, open records, and expungements. Policy option packages for this section include Package 208, Infrastructure and Field Support. This package would provide free support service supervisor positions. The outcome measure for this addition within the AFIS regulatory and firearms units will greatly improve our overall ability to meet unit performance goals and customer needs for mandated services. Better support to staff in the areas of after-hour supervision, scheduling, quality assurance, and training. Better frontline operational and technological oversight of workflow and process improvements. Support for direct supervision of staff and day-to-day operations will allow each program manager to focus on proactive business planning, budgeting, and general administration within each unit. Success will be measured through internal review of monthly statistics for workload trends and adherence to established turnaround times. That concludes my presentation for the Identification Services section. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I want to go back to staff retention and training, because you mentioned that you had a turnover and you weren't able to, once you trained them, then they would go on to a higher paying job. Two questions. One, what is your turnover rate of staff? And two, have you considered, if we're losing staff because of the issue of salary, because it costs you more to bring in somebody new to train them, and then if we're losing them, have you looked at the possibility of maybe the range is not accurate or adequate?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters. I don't have a turnover percentage. I'll be happy to get that information for you. To your question regarding, if I understood it correctly, we've been having that very discussion about whether the cost of training, recruiting, the entire process of addressing the difficulties we're experiencing with turnover equates to the fact that maybe these folks aren't being paid sufficiently enough to get them to stay. That is an issue that we are taking a look at. Obviously, that's also a labor relations issue that we'll have to pursue.
Do follow. Are you having the discussion with DAS and Human Resources to actually look at and do what's comparable, what we're doing compared to other states, and looking at that whole salary range issue? Because as one who's been in business, I know the cost of investing in a person coming in for training. And so it just seems to me if the issue is that once you train them, then they look outside and go someplace else, you're constantly in a training position. And that can be extremely costly.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, we have had dialogue with DAS on selected positions. Some of the positions that we've had most difficulty with, we have had some discussions with DAS about those. I think our current feeling is that we probably need to take a look at all of the turnover areas within ID services, develop a strategy to try to retain our folks better than what we've experienced in the past.
Senator Burdick and then Representative Barker.
On your, thank you, Mr. Chair. On your firearms InstaCheck system, that's supposed to be self-supporting. I think it's $10 per check now. I just wanted to find out if that is still penciling out in terms of being self-supporting.
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, we have not done a recent evaluation of all of the positions at ID that are funded with the fees. As you recall, last legislative session, we adopted a new fee schedule. We're due to begin the process of evaluating the fees that we're currently recovering and evaluating the staffing that we currently require.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair, on the same program, the gun show backgrounds at gun shows measure that passed in 2000 by my initiative, contained a provision for individual citizens as well as licensed dealers to call in and get a background check for sale of a firearm. It was intended for people at gun shows, but I believe it was available to any private citizen who wanted to do a background check before selling a firearm. Is that being used much, or are you finding that licensed dealers are doing most of those checks at gun shows?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, I don't have the answer to that question off the top of my head, but I'll be happy to check and get you an answer.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. If I can ask you a quick fingerprint question. Representative Cameron was to try to get a job working in a nursing home, and so he's fingerprinted to be sure he doesn't have a criminal background. He doesn't. Are those fingerprints kept, or are they just, once that's clear, are they dismissed, or do those go back to a filing system so that he's a duck hunter if he's out hunting with Vice President Cheney and he gets shot? And then
Chair Shields, Representative Barker.
Cheney and drive with Kennedy. And actually, we're interested to know those fingerprints that you're keeping on Representative Cameron.
Yeah.
What's happening with them?
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, it depends on the statute and the language in the statute whether the prints are kept or not. We have some statutes and classifications where we're required to retain them and others that we are to destroy them.
And if you retain them, is that retaining do you have access to that, or are you just look for them?
Potentially both.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
So watch out, Representative Cameron.
Well, let's keep rolling.
That just begs the question. We keep some, we don't keep others. I mean, based on the language in the statute, what's the statute say? Which ones do you keep? Which ones don't you keep? And why?
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, I'd be happy to provide you with a report that describes that entire process, if that would be helpful.
Okay.
I mean, is that going to take a lot of work, or do you have that?
Yeah, don't break your
face. We've got that information should be relatively simple to pull together.
Okay, yeah. That would be helpful for us to see.
May not satisfy your question.
It's a cursory question. You know, the system's working. Yeah. I've used it. I hate to say that in front of Jenny Burdick. But I will say this, there is peace in the valley because Jenny Burdick supported an NRA-sponsored bill the other day. This is true. I dare you to deny it.
You did?
Yes, she did.
Internet hunting.
I'm not surprised.
So did you?
I love it.
If you call your attention to page 80, we'll be doing the enterprise services section next. And in the interest of brevity, Mr. Chair, when I get to the outcome measures, there are several positions that are proposed under Governor's Rec for this particular program. We have recommended outcomes identified for each of the positions. I'm prepared to go into that level of detail if you like, or if not, be happy to put together an overview that lists that, but we put quite a bit of thought into what we would hope to accomplish should we get the positions.
I think, I mean, in the interest of brevity, I'd like to get this wrapped up by 4:30 unless you want to come back tomorrow. So I'll leave that up to you. Would you like to wrap up at 4:30 or come back because you think it's important?
If we have time to get through this section, the last one would be the wireless services section. And from a continuity perspective, it might, if you're still doing Mike Zanin with the Owen update, there's some continuity there between our wireless services section and Owen that might be realized if I came back tomorrow and finished up with wireless.
Okay. Yeah, why don't we just get through this one and then come back tomorrow.
The enterprise services section is the department's IT or computer services shop. The section consists of 8 staff members responsible for supporting approximately 1,200 computing devices and over 20 business applications. The section also provides limited help desk support, IT procurement assistance, maintains the department's website, and supports all OSP divisions who require IT project-related support and services. There are 4 key budget drivers for this section. Budget driver number 1 is agency demands for IT support. The current demands for IT support of OSP's diverse divisions far exceeds the staff capacity of the enterprise services section. The section lacks the staff resources and skill sets necessary to support an agency the size of OSP. With only 8 employees, the section provides minimal support, requiring the constant triage of service requests and little or no proactive management of the department's network and IT infrastructure. The result has been the loss of data, system or application unavailability, equipment failure, and unsatisfactory network and desktop performance. In the end, the lack of adequate staffing contributes to lost productivity and service delays throughout the department. Budget driver number 2 is increased dependency on IT technology. OSP's employees and their divisions drive the services and support required of our enterprise services section. As new technology and customer requirements evolve, ESS must be capable of understanding the business needs of its customers and matching them with the best technological solutions available. It is imperative that ESS staff not only manage, maintain, and operate IT tools at a high level, but serve the role as business analyst, knowing how the tools can best be applied to meet the business needs of the division. Budget driver 3 is lifecycle replacement of IT resources. Computers and software age with time and become incompatible with newer equipment. They become a liability to security and the stability of customer service. ESS has historically been reactive where it involves lifecycle replacement, replacing only what breaks or what available monies will allow. As funding becomes available, a proactive approach will be taken to ensure maximum security and performance and functionality are available to ESS customers. And budget driver number 4 is information sharing. Throughout the country, the ability to access and share information has become a critical public safety trend. OSP is behind in this regard, and its partners are demanding access to the department's information. used for apprehending criminals and solving crime, to managing budgets and measuring performance, ESS plays a critical role in facilitating the technological requirements necessary to allow the desired and appropriate exchange of information. Continuous improvements and efficiencies in this section include standardization. Department hardware and software has been standardized and IT procurement centralized. User-to-user compatibility, employee familiarization with hardware and software, and cost are the primary benefits. Standardization has also provided improved information flow, resulting in enhanced staff productivity and efficiency through familiarization, common training, and overall systems compatibility. This practice also delivers improved systems performance obtained through common system management, technical support, and systems maintenance. Central Help Desk. And I might add, because we don't have a full-time help desk per se, we actually use a voicemail system. So anybody in our department that has a problem with their computer, they call a number, they leave a message on a voicemail system, and as soon as our available technical staff can retrieve the calls from the voicemail system and respond, that's how the help desk for OSP presently works. IT support and procurement services are requested through a central help desk. The majority of calls for service are resolved during the initial call, resulting in improved responsiveness and less downtime at individual user level. This also allows senior technicians to concentrate on more difficult issues in an uninterrupted manner. The overall result is improved productivity and systems availability while allowing for the development of empirical information regarding systems performance, service delivery, awareness of reoccurring issues, and a single point of contact for our customers. Internal support. Network services and associated infrastructure has been supported with internal staff versus outsourcing to commercial vendors. Improved network performance, availability, and throughput through the use of OSP staff versus vendor resources are realized at a reduced cost. Use of OSP staff reduces required support since network servers and infrastructure are the same at all locations. In addition, dedicated staff tends to be more responsive to system changes, problem resolution, and service restoration. Remote access. Remote email, internet access, and online data services was established for small to intermediate locations in OSP via the web. This approach was taken instead of creating a dedicated data network to provide these services. The result is improved information exchange and staff productivity at remote locations where data circuits previously could not be cost justified and at less than half the cost. This solution also delivers email and internet access to department staff after hours and while on the road. Performance outcomes for this section include provide improved customer service and IT systems management through increased staffing. A survey conducted by DAS in December of 2005 demonstrates the significance of OSP's IT staff shortage when comparing comparably sized state agencies. Comparisons include the Oregon Department of Justice, which has 62 IT positions, the Oregon Department of Revenue with 97 IT positions, and the Oregon Youth Authority with 24 IT positions. According to the 2006 IT staffing survey prepared by the International Legal Technology Association, their survey of 287 member organizations determined the ratio of users to IT staff ranged from 26 to 1 for very large firms, and they were defined as being firms with over 500 users, to 38 to 1 for small firms, and that's fewer than 150 users. OSP has 1,048 users who require support from ESS with only 8 IT staff. Next is to provide application support services. With no system development, program, or analyst positions, we have no staff dedicated to supporting our current applications. We are constantly challenged to keep the existing systems running. The following OSP applications require ESS support. Again, in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I won't go through the entire list, but to give you some examples, we have the CARE system, which is our evidence tracking system, the Aspen system, which is our truck inspection program, our accident reconstruction application, fish and wildlife application, patrol logs, The list goes on and on, but these are applications that our divisions rely on to do their work. We have nobody today in our shop that can actually support those applications. So essentially, we have to buy those services from either the private sector acquire them through the folks, or try to track down the folks that originally created the application in the first place. Provide project management services. With only one project manager, ESS is not able to provide essential project management support, planning, tracking, quality assurance, etc., for projects that OSP initiates. The following list of known OSP IT projects require ESS support. Again, we've got a substantial list, but some of the examples are currently in the state of Oregon, we have 30-some-odd live scan devices located throughout the state that are used to take fingerprints from individuals and transmit those fingerprints to the ID Bureau. Right now, we're using the live scan system essentially as a facsimile machine or a fax machine, faxing the prints to ID, which then has to be scanned into the APHIS system for transmittal to WIN. Direct connecting all of these would bypass all of that process, improve the quality of the prints that are sent to WIN for storage, significant reduction in the amount of time it takes to actually complete that particular process. That's an example of a project that we need to initiate, but with one project manager, that person's time is stretched very thin. A prioritized list of programs and services for this section include technical support, help desk services, state data center liaison, application support, and project management. Policy option packages for this section include Package 101, Essential Infrastructure. This package would provide a full-time technical services supervisor position. The position would supervise the help desk process, our technicians, and quality assurance on the IT procurement process. The outcome measure would be that we provide metrics for the time that's required to respond to help desk calls, tracking all of our expenditures. Again, this is another area where we have a list of outcome measures that we've identified for these positions. I'd be happy to provide that in more detail if you'd like. Package 208, Infrastructure and Field Support. This package would provide a full-time chief information officer, a help desk customer service coordinator, and three technicians. And once again, Mr. Chair, with your guidance, I can go into detail what we would propose to do if we were to get those positions.
Yeah, I think at this point, if you could just get those to us on paper.
Be happy to.
That would be helpful.
Be happy to. That actually concludes my presentation for the Enterprise Services section.
Okay, we've got a minute for questions if anybody has them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron, just real quick, I wrote down customers. You refer to your customers. Are those the people within the Oregon State Police that have a computer? Is that a customer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that's correct. The Enterprise Services section is OSP's IT support group. So if a division has an application that supports their particular program, if their computer breaks, if they have problems running the software that's on their computer, this section.
If I may,
support.
Just so I can get my hands around a real life. Yesterday when we toured the crime lab, we saw the evidence barcode system that they check in. Would that be a system that this division would be in charge of helping and taking care of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, yes. I'm glad you raised that point, because one of the technicians that we are asking for in this particular section would provide a full-time technician for supporting the crime lab. Currently, we have a qualified forensics technician, Jim Bixby, serving as the IT support in that shop, because we have nobody else to support them. We have nobody at ID Services to support the IT needs of ID Services, and it's very IT dependent. This is probably one of the sections within our department that is woefully lacking staff resources. And to give you an example, the end of 2001, before the budget fell apart, we had 26 staff members in this section. And at its worst, May of 2003, it was down to 6. We're at 8 today. So we are in dire need of some help in this particular section.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, this meeting is adjourned. Nice job.